Okay, we'll start with a breath meditation, as usual. Okay, so please sit up straight. Please check in with your face. Is it loose? The muscles are not tight. Corners of the mouth are relaxed. Remember, we're going into neutral. The mind is very busy from the morning. Maybe some of us have already done our emails and texts, and the breath meditation is meant to bring the mind to a neutral state. The tummy is slightly tightened to loosen the lower back. Could bring your shoulder blades together slightly in the back, which brings the chest out. You can play with cracking your eyes open slightly. I think one more day of trying it might be fun, and you might decide you like it sometimes. The trick is not to focus on anything, which means everybody has to be very still and not move, because motion catches the eye. And then slowly come to your breath. At first, don't count it, just watch it. The mind is parked at the tip of the nostrils, at the opening of the nostrils, and we're observing the touch in like a quarter inch of space at the end of the nostrils inside. The touch of warm, moist air going out and dry, cool air coming in. We're not even trying to count yet. The mind will slip away to things you have to do today. Emails, texts, things that people said this morning. And then gently bring it back. Don't wrestle with it. Coax it back. Meditation is learning to be the boss of your own mind and not letting the mind be the boss. Now try to begin counting the breath. The exhalation, the out-breath, is the first half, and the inhalation is the second half. See if you can count to 10 without losing count, without thinking of something else. It's very difficult to catch your own mind thinking of something else. If you're very, very strictly honest with yourself, which you should be, you'll find that the mind slips away from the breath within two or three numbers. Then just patiently start over again. then slowly come out of the meditation. You can stretch your arms.
Take a good stretch.
Any questions so far?
No.
Yes, please. Loud, okay?
I don't even know how to construct this sentence, but question. We were talking about things being mutually exclusive. I told you going in any category of meditation. And I was wondering how that helps you understand emptiness. I'm not sure.
That's a good question. So she's asking about the idea of how things can be mutually exclusive and how that could help us understand emptiness. This is a big subject in Buddhism, which is called Gelwa. Say Gelwa. Yeah. It's a dry subject, okay? There are two kinds of contradiction possible in the world. One is called Tlenchik Menengel. Say Tlenchik Menengel. And the second one is called Pensin Pangya. One is a contradiction, meaning what do you call it? Incompatibility. And the other is a contradiction of identity. Okay. So, but it has real life applications. I'm getting there. Okay. Contradiction in terms of what do you call it? What was the first one? Incompatibility. In the scriptures, they say a crow and I forget, an owl. They don't like each other, apparently. So if a crow is on a branch of a tree, the owl can't be there, you know. So that applies to incompatibility, for example, of cold and hot. So if heat is present in a place, like the top of your stove, then ice can't stay there, you know. The heat will overcome the ice will melt. So that's a contradiction of incompatibility. Then there's a contradiction of identity, meaning my perception of Tad. Tad to me has to be either coming from his own side or coming from me, okay? And those two things are mutually incompatible. They cannot be both be true. Okay? He's either coming from his side. Let's say he criticizes me, okay? So then how do I react to that? How do I use incompatibility to be a better person? Okay? Which all Buddhist teachings, no matter how dry they are, you gotta try to see why Lord Buddha taught them and what use they have. So he says something unkind to me. Then I look at him and I think, is it coming from him or is it coming from me? It's either one or the other. It can't be both. You see what I mean? That's the second kind of incompatibility of identity. He cannot be a person coming from himself and at the same time be a person who's coming from me. He has to be one or the other. One pushes the other out of the same space. Then in Buddhist practice, when I reflect on emptiness, it's that, oh, emptiness means he's not what he appears to be. That's emptiness. You could call it, I don't know, absence. You see, there's no Tad in the room who's coming from his side. That's emptiness. And that's how you can use it in your real life, okay? There's no Tad coming from his side. The Tad that I see is coming from how I treated people last week. You see what I mean? That's, by the way, if you care, that's dependent origination. Okay? What Tad I see is coming from how I treated people last week or the week before. Okay? And that's incompatible with a Tad that's coming from his own side. So who decided to criticize me? I did. All right. Then the whole point is in your reaction. You see, I mean, like, it's too late to do anything about the current criticism, you know. Forces are in motion. I have been judgmental of other people, and so he's criticized. There's nothing I can do about this moment. In Buddhism, it's like saying, pushing a tree back into the ground. It's too late. I can pluck tree seeds out of the dirt now and prevent trees next week or a month from now. So the important thing in understanding his emptiness is that I respond to him properly and don't plant new seeds. You see, I mean bad seeds. So then I have this thing, I call it water on the bathroom floor. Okay, and I told you this story, but to put it briefly, if it's winter in New Jersey and you have one pair of wool socks and you go into the bathroom, and it's like Saturday, you don't have to work. You get the day off. So I used to recover on Saturdays. I wouldn't get up till like noon because I didn't get enough sleep during the week. So I would recover on Saturdays. Then I'd go take a shower and the floor is all wet. The floor is soaked, you know. And then I go to the other monks and I'm like, you know, this is not Tibet, this is America, you know. You're supposed to clean the, you're supposed to close the shower curtain. You know, and then they'd all look at me and say, it wasn't me, it wasn't me, it wasn't me. Then somebody would say, you got up at 5:30 and took a shower this morning, you know. And then you're like, oh yeah, because you thought it was a weekday. I used to have to get up at 5:30 to catch the bus to New York. And, you know, so then I forgot. On Saturday, sometimes I'd just get up like an automaton, like a robot, and take a shower, and then I'd go back to bed. And so then, can you get angry if you know you stepped in your own water? You see, it's just you feel stupid, or you feel dumb, or you think next time I should be more careful, like that. That's how incompatibility or contradiction applies to emptiness, applies to your real life. Okay, he can't be coming from his side and coming from me at the same time. Okay, that's a long answer. Any more question? Yeah, go ahead.
I've heard several presentations of like the where karma is stored.
Yeah, good. Okay.
One of them we talked about the drop of the
yeah. Yeah.
And another one I've heard about, it seems like I think it was later on in ECA 13 where it talks about the projections themselves.
Oh yeah, okay.
And I kind of, when I heard that, it kind of made sense, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, he said, Tim's talking about where your karma is stored, where does your karma stay, you know. When I got to India, I don't know, in 1973 or something, and I think this is one of the first arguments I ever heard. Somebody was asking my teacher at the time, Geshe Dagye, where is karma stored? Because you have this feeling that it's stored out near Jupiter somewhere. You know what I mean? In your heart, you feel like it must be somewhere, you know, the seeds must be stored somewhere. It is traditionally said that in the heart chakra, which is at the level of the heart in front of the spine, there's a central channel. Inside that is the heart chakra, and inside that is a tiny spot which is described as the size of the tip of a pin, and it's called Mishigbe Tigle, which means the indestructible drop. And that drop is only released on two occasions in a person's life. One is at the height of orgasm, and one is at death. And then the fluids of the body release in both cases. When you die, urine and feces, when you have orgasm, other fluids, right? So you access that drop only on several occasions in a human life. And then, so how I see Tad is coming when seeds in my mind open, right? They open in my mind. There is a white patch there, and there is brown patch and a dark patch. There are three patches there. The eyeball can't identify them. The eyeball only, it's like a camera, what do you call that? the cells that record the photograph, the cells at the back of the eye are only sensitive to color and shape. They cannot evaluate what the thing is. The mind has to figure out what the patches are, right? The patches at the back of the retinal, the cells of the retina are passive. They only shift from dark to light, round to straight. They can't decide what is that thing. So the mind must decide that. How the mind interprets him is coming from your karma. Okay, so I'm unkind to someone, or let's say I'm kind to someone last week. So I'm considerate, I'm thoughtful, I reach out to someone last week, okay? Then he comes in and to me to this morning and says, you know, he says something, which again is only decibels, okay? It's not content. It's higher and lower sounds. It's sibilants, gutturals, dentals, labials. It's just buck, duck, bit, doop, buck, buck, you know? And then my ear can only hear that. Then my mind has to interpret it into speech. How the mind interprets it is a flowering of karma from your seeds. Oh, he said something nice to me. Or he said something mean to me. He could say the same syllables, and I would hear it two different ways, depending. And you know that, because not everybody likes Cowgirl in the Sand. Neil Young. The good Neil Young. Okay? Okay, so we all hear things differently. We all see things differently. And that's because of the opening of the seeds. I think I'm going to twist your question to a bigger question, okay, which I often do. That means that everything is subjective. That means that how I treated people last week is deciding what I see in my life and how people treat me. And even the amount of traffic and the weather. All those things are coming from me, right? The big question then is the laws of karma, the laws in which those seeds ripen, are they fixed? Are they coming from their own side? Are they the only thing that's coming from their own side? You see? And if not, then would it be possible to commit an unkind deed and get a good result? You know? Is karma itself subjective? You know? That's the huge question, you know? That's a big question. And the answer is, it is subjective. Different people can... Let's say that I do something kind. Let's say I spend 30 years teaching for free, you know, and translating 20,000 pages and working without stop, 24/7, small patches of sleep in there. Let's say I do that, right? And then that's a good karma, right? If the intention was good, if the intention wasn't just attention, intention wasn't attention, right? If the intention was good, then that should have a good result, right? And then if I experience a bad result from those efforts, in my perception, it could be the case that doing kindness results in suffering. You see what I mean? Got it? I could have a misperception of the laws of karma. Because I had been disrespecting those laws or something like that, okay? So it is possible. People come to me and say, I'm giving up this charitable project that you put me on because I'm tired and unhappy all the time, you know? And then I'll say, well, that's not because you were helping people. That's because you didn't help people, you know? And then they'll say, no, I was happier when I didn't have good projects to do. You know, and then you say, okay. You know, so it is possible to perceive the laws of karma in a mistaken way because of your own actions. Okay? So even the laws of karma, how you perceive them, is whether you perceive them as true or false is coming from you. Yeah. Is that okay? It's also subjective. Okay? It doesn't mean that they are subjective. That's another story. Okay. I'd like to, you know, a subject came up last night where we've reached a point in the preparation for meditation where we attempt to visualize something, okay? And we haven't really done a lot of that, you know. There's a training on how to visualize stuff, okay? So I thought we would do that, okay? Let's try. We'll do the visualization from yesterday, and then I'll give you some clues about how to get good at visualizing, okay? All right? All right, here we go. Please come to your breath. Prepare by watching your breath. Loosen your face. Relax your face. Tighten your tummy slightly. Release any tension in your hands. Release your shoulders. Don't hold your shoulders. It may be better to close your eyes this time, I think. It'll get confusing. Relax your jaw, your lips, your teeth. So the visualization that we did yesterday, that we spoke about last night from the text, was to picture a Buddha. What I'd like to suggest, and that Buddha was your own personal teacher. And in our culture, we didn't grow up with a lot of Buddha pictures around us or Buddha statues. So what I'd like to do is, what I suggest is to we will try to visualize our own teacher. So if you have a personal teacher, we'll be visualizing them. If you don't have a personal teacher yet, then we can visualize an idealized personal teacher, how you imagine they might be, that you saw in Kung Fu on TV. So the trick of visualization of a being, a good way to start, and in the scriptures, a traditional way to start, is just to get their outline right. And there was even a case where Lord Buddha asked his disciples to hang a sheet in front of him, and then he had other disciples light lamps behind him. And the disciple sitting in front only saw his silhouette projected onto the sheet. So what I'd like you to do, imagine that your teacher, your personal teacher, is sitting in front of you, you're going to try to do a meditation where you're sitting with your own teacher, which could be your mom or your dad or a school teacher you had or anyone that you respect, and just try to connect with their silhouette. We'll begin visualizing our teacher sitting in front of us, knee to knee, as a silhouette. Just try to get their outline steady in your mind without thinking of other things. I'll give you a few minutes for that. Last night, the text went into great detail about the hands of the teacher, how the hands are placed. The right hand drapes over the knee and the calf and is touching, the middle finger is touching the ground. The left hand is cupped in the teacher's lap. And traditionally, that would be holding a bowl with three different nectars in it, the nectar which overcomes illness in our body, and then the nectar which overcomes death itself, and then the nectar which overcomes the cause of those two things, which is our own negative thoughts. So what I'd like you to do is keep the silhouette, just the outline, shoulders, head, sides of the body, knees. And then I would like you to try to, there's almost no color yet, try to get the silhouette of the right hand and then move on to the silhouette of the left hand. So really you just have a black and white silhouette, maybe some grays, and the outline of the right hand articulated, touching the ground, and the outline of the left hand in the teacher's lap, palm up. See if we can detail just the two hands, the outline of the two hands, and the outline of the Lama's body. Okay, one last step in learning to visualize. Focus on the teacher's eyes and imagine, although your own eyes are closed, imagine that your eyes are open and that you are gazing into the eyes of your teacher. So there's a peripheral awareness of the outline of the Lama's body. There's some awareness of their hands, but the main focus of the visualization is upon their eyes now. And articulate the shape of the eyes, the shape of the eyelids, the eyebrows, and now introduce color. So maybe their eyes are brown or green or blue, and try to see color in their eyes and the human moment-to-moment changes in a person's eyes, shifting, eyelids blinking. See if you can make the eyes real. There's a very common tendency to visualize our teacher as a photograph or as a statue. So we're going to try to make the eyes living eyes. They have color, and they are glistening, and they are blinking from time to time. And most importantly, in the scriptures, there's an intense feeling of love coming out of their eyes. They are looking at me. They are looking into my eyes with an intense feeling of love and care. And that makes the visualization real. So focus on just their eyes for a few minutes. Make them alive and make them intensely loving. then please slowly come back to your breath. And then when you're ready, open your eyes. Take a stretch. So I want to emphasize on visualization that I think even the word visualization is not very good. It means visual, right? And don't let it be that. I think many people, and myself, we tend to picture a photograph and not a living person, right? So later when you want to, on top of the eyes, I like to add the other senses, which are more, what do you call it? They're more profound. Like to a smell, a fragrance, is much more triggers a presence of someone than the shirt that they're wearing, right? So when you, as you progress in visualizing, try to bring in other senses. You can hear the rustling of their breath. You can smell the fragrance from their body. When someone's very close to you, they say, if you've ever been close to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, they say there's a thing called sutungituma, which means the fragrance of an especially moral person. And it's like jasmine or something. And it's nice when you're visualizing your teacher to imagine that fragrance. You can just a very faint fragrance of ethical life. It comes off of their body, right? And then the warmth, when you're very close up to someone, you can feel the radiating heat from their body on the skin of your arms or your cheek, and imagine, try to imagine those things also. Make the visualization complete, okay? What's the point of visualization? Why are we doing that? It plants a seeds in your mind to meet the real thing, okay? It plants seeds in your mind to meet the real thing. And they say, you know, like Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Dalai Lama's lineage, he meditated on Manjushri for a long time. And he did the knees, and he did the hands, and he did the outline, and then he did the fragrance, and then he got up to the warmth, and then one day Manjushri started talking, you know, and it was the real thing, you know, because that's also coming from your mind, you see. So if you plant the seeds by visualizing some kind of angel, then we believe that you will meet them someday. And then he was all excited, and he started asking him questions. He was a nudnik, Jetsonkhapa, and he kept asking questions to Manjushri. Okay, earlier in his life, he couldn't speak to Manjushri, and he had a teacher who could. His teacher was called Lama Umapa, and he was a shepherd, and in many. On the mountains, in private meditations with his sheep, he got contact with Manjushri, the angel of wisdom, right? And then Jetsonkhapa heard about that claim, and he started asking Lama Umapa questions to ask Manjushri, and then he got really good answers, like supernaturally good answers back. And so then, for a while, Lama Umapa asked the questions for him. And then he taught Jetsonkhapa how to visualize Manjushri, and then how to, what do you call it, manifest him. And then later he he just could talk to Manjushri directly and get good answers to questions. All right. Any more questions? Yes, please.
2 days ago, I think, you spoke about how to, like, when you do something, just concentrate on one thing.
Yeah, good.
And I had a question about how that relates to some different ways that are taught to do yoga.
Yeah. Yeah, good. A couple of answers, okay? One of the ideas is a concept in Buddhism called Simba. Say Simba.
Simba.
Low tone, Simba.
Simba.
Simba means that the classical example is Semkeki Simba, which means imbued. Your mind is imbued with a desire to help other people. Okay, that's called Semkeki Simba. So there's a debate about the first perception of emptiness, direct perception of emptiness. At that time, you cannot be the first perception of ultimate reality by a person. During those minutes, 20 minutes or so, they're not capable of having love at the same time manifest in their mind. Okay, they can't think of a normal object other than ultimate reality, just pure ultimate reality, pure communion with ultimate reality. And they're not capable of thinking about other people in those 20 minutes, okay? Because people are not ultimate reality. Then, so there's this huge debate in the scriptures, you know, if a bodhisattva who has devoted their life to the service of others just goes into the direct perception of emptiness, then are they no longer a bodhisattva for 20 minutes? You see what I mean? And then it gets kind of weird, okay? Then you can't say the bodhisattva is seeing emptiness, you know? It's like he's not a bodhisattva because he doesn't have that love manifest in his mind or her mind. And then the answer is, Semkeki Simba means their mind is imbued or soaked in love and concern for others. And then it's like a mother is having love for their child. Then the child, there's that story of children getting trapped under cars, and the mother runs over and lifts up the car. And in that moment, their mind is imbued or soaked in love for the child, concern for the child. But they're focusing on the car, and their whole mind is on the car. But they're being driven by their love. So the love is not manifest in the mind, but the whole drive is coming from that love. Okay? So in the moment of the direct perception of emptiness, you don't have a conscious awareness of love, but your mind is soaked in it. They call Semkeki Simba. So ideally, when you do a yoga series, a yoga asana series, then in the Tibetan heart yoga system, before you start your yoga, you're standing at the front of your mat and you choose someone for whom you will do your yoga. And then you wish upon them one of the six great virtues of Buddhism. Okay? You're wishing upon them one of the six great virtues of Buddhism, which are, number one, the giving, the willingness to give and share. Okay? Number two, morality, ethical lifestyle. Number three, patience, not getting angry when you should get angry. Number four, enjoying doing nice stuff. Somebody says, there's a TV show on tonight, but the homeless shelter needs a volunteer. And you're like, let's go. You know, you don't hesitate to do something that's wholesome and virtuous. Okay. Then number five, meditation. Number six, understanding where Tad comes from. Okay, really. Okay, you can call it wisdom, but that's what it really means. Okay, so when you do a heart yoga series, you get up to the front of the mat, and before you start your yoga, you think of someone. Maybe someone who's not so generous, and therefore they're having financial troubles. Okay, or someone who's angry a lot. And then you say, I'm going to do this yoga for them. Okay. Then you start your yoga. So Anatole's question is, if it's true, as Dharmakirti, Master Dharmakirti said, chiki nishi mayante, right? Chiki nishi mayante. One state of mind cannot hold two objects at the same time. You can toggle between them instantaneously, right? But it's not possible to focus on the person that you want to help and be aware of your breathing, or be aware of your movements, right? So, and it gets, it would also be distracting to try. So what you do is the Simke Kisimba thing. You're very, very conscious at the beginning of the asana of the person who needs some help. And then you say, I'm going to dedicate this poses to you. Then you leave it. You let it just soak your mind. And then you really focus on your breath, or you really focus on the movements, or like that. But the mind is soaked in concern for the other person. And on a practical level, when you're in a spinal twist or something, and you're stuck there for 5 breaths, you can come back to them. You know that. You know, you can come back to them. Last thing, okay? My teacher, my Tibetan teacher, Ken Rinpoche, he learned from his Lama, Tijan Rinpoche, who is the teacher of the current Dalai Lama. So the current Dalai Lama's heart teacher was my teacher's heart teacher. That teacher's heart teacher was Pobok Rinpoche, who wrote the book we're studying for 10 years. And my teacher met Pobok Rinpoche when he was a teenager. And that's a long story. That's a beautiful story. He served him for some time. But anyway, the most important tantric teaching of that lineage for the last 1,000 years is called Vajrayogini. And this is an angel. This is a very beautiful, kind, nice angel, right? And in my teachers, back 41 generations, you're the 42nd, I'm the 42nd, you're the 43rd generation. They have tried to visualize this beautiful angel and make contact with her. Starting with the knees and the hands. You see what I mean? Exactly what we just did. So the visualization process takes about 2 hours. You know, the traditional process, the training of a session to try to picture that angel takes about 2 hours. And it's very, it's a series of visualizations. And it moves quickly. It goes from one thing to another thing to another thing to another thing. So then my teacher, late in his life, approached Tijan Rinpoche and said he had a question, you know. This is a famous question that he asked Tijan Rinpoche. I think it was even carved into Tijan Rinpoche's autobiography. But he asked Tijan Rinpoche, why don't we just do one visualization? You know, why is the visualization moving so quickly through a dozen visualizations, you know? How can that be single-pointed, you know? Because it's not one thing. It's like dozens of separate scenes in that visualization. So he complained to Ken Rinpoche complained to Tridhar Rinpoche, I can't stay single-pointed on that because it's so many things, you know? And then Tridhar Rinpoche got really upset at him and said, oh, no, no, no. The whole thing is one movie. Okay? Like you're focusing on Jane Eyre, the whole movie. See what I mean? You don't pick one scene. The whole 2 hours of scenes is one movie. So you are one pointed on a movie. Got it? So maybe it applies. Maybe that question applies. It's a wonderful question because it can get very tiring to try to visualize dozens of scenes in that practice. So I think pull that out. You know, on a practical level, choose a person at the beginning, come back to them when you have a pause in the series, like you're paused in a twist or something like that. Yeah. Cool. All right. Speaking of yoga, we're going to do, I would just like to do a nice, soft, gentle niguma to some music. I don't have the cool music that Anton has. I was trying to steal the songs yesterday. I have a thing called Soundhound. So every time because I'm like of a different generation, I missed a couple generations during my monastic training. I call it my blackout period. And so 25 years I didn't hear any rock and roll except at the laundromat. And so I was sitting there yesterday there were like five or six songs that were really beautiful. I like his taste in music, and I was like, oh, I need this song, you know. So anyway, I didn't have time to make a new songs for you. I have the same old one, which is classical music. But I find it calming, and it's Sunday, and so I suggest we just do that. So you have like a 10-minute break, and then if Johnny is or somebody can help me with the setting up the music. Also, I'd like to introduce David Grandin. Can you stand up? David was teaching a class I went to in Flagstaff one day, and I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was an awesome class. And I asked him if he would come down and teach the intermediate advanced class today. And he kindly agreed. So we don't know each other very well, except he's tortured me a few times. And he'll be teaching the intermediate class after